You're listening to The Daily Mayo, a podcast from BBC Radio 5 Live. For more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello and welcome to another Daily Mayo. Today I spoke to the man who was in charge of the Met's counter-terrorism unit when the July 7 terror attacks on London happened. He's former Assistant Commissioner Andy Heyman. The interview followed a conversation with our Washington correspondent about claims that the American security services had concerns about the army psychiatrist who shot dead 13 soldiers at an army base in Texas before the attack. Just on that American story, and obviously you're not an American analyst with no specialist knowledge about the proceedings at Fort Hood, but it does raise questions, which I think Paul was just touching on then towards the end of our conversation, about how potential attackers, dangerous people are spotted, how the information is passed on, who analyses what, who passes the information on to which different organization. It's a complex story.
Yeah.
What do you make of what you've heard of that, and how does it sort of fit into what you learnt in your time at the Met?
Well, it's no different whatever side of the pond you sit. Counterterrorism, by its mere nature, is a world of secrecy. It has to be because of the sensitive nature of the investigations. And what you're trying to make sense of is a real complex web of contact, suspicion, reliable intelligence that's coming into you. And at the end of that, you're only as good as what you know or you suspect. And when you want to try and keep the integrity of that information, keep it very close, only those who need to know, you have to strike a really difficult balance. On the one hand, it has to be secret, but on the other, not so secret that actually you're not making best use of all your colleagues and all your partner agencies. And that is always very difficult. What we're seeing here is someone that now we know about this individual and the terrible things that he's done or suspected to have done, alleged to have done. We now have to try and build the picture backwards as opposed to building it forwards. And so inevitably, what you're looking at now is his contacts with people, his mode of behaviour, the type of conversations he may or may not be having with people, operated within that complex web and world of secrecy, and it's not an easy task.
Yes, and very easy to be wise after the event, and there'll always be maybe a piece of information that you think, well, why didn't someone spot the fact that he was coming up with those particular comments, meeting with these particular individuals?
Yes, but of course, the trouble with all this is that, you've got to be very careful of the line you're treading here, because it's not an offence, unless you're in a conspiracy, to associate with a criminal. A recent trial of the alleged backroom team of the 7-7 bombers, yes, they did associate with the 7-7 bombers, but as the judge ruled then, and I don't think it's any different in America, as long as you're not involved in a conspiracy, the association is not illegal. So therefore, the authorities are going to be very careful that they don't overstep the mark in suspecting someone or putting them in the ray of suspicion just because of that association. And I think bringing it back close to home, if you look at the terrible atrocities that we suffered here in London when we saw the first ever suicide bombers on the streets, those bombers weren't on the intelligence radar. However difficult that is to say, that is the case. And so therefore, sometimes when there's a tragedy, you have to work backwards rather than forwards.
What was the main motive for you writing this account, Andy? Was it to, I mean, some people said it, you know, settling scores, but was it just to put your side of a pretty extraordinary job?
Yeah, I mean, I thought long and hard before I put pen to paper, and I consulted with colleagues. It was never going to be an autobiography. It was never going to be a kiss and tell or settle any scores. And I think if you read the book, that you can come to that conclusion. What it is a responsible account of what went on in this country between just before the bombings in July 05, right the way through to when I retired. And unfortunately, there's not been any real major attack since that time. So there's a snapshot in history. And I just didn't want the good work of not only the police, but also the intelligence agencies to go unreported in history, because no one could write an account. And the difficulty when you then embark on such a project is, going back to where I started in this conversation, is that you don't want to be irresponsible. It's got to be accurate reporting. But a lot of the things that you'd like to talk about, it would be irresponsible to talk about, because you would show basically all the tricks of the trade. Mm. What this book tries to do is navigate that difficult route.
Just as it was coming out back in July, there was a last-minute injunction against the book. What can you tell us about that, if anything?
Well, I mean, it's intriguing, really, because I set out to make sure that the right people were vetting this, both in terms of lawyers and the relevant agencies. And indeed, on some chapters, from feedback, I made over 100 edits to make sure it did navigate responsibly. We now can talk about the reasons why the Attorney General saw it differently. It had been on the bookshelves for about a week, and it was going very well in terms of sales. And there was some reference in there to an ongoing trial. And the judgment of the Attorney General's office was that that would potentially undermine. We went to the High Court to get a judgment on that, not necessarily to be too bullish about it, but more about to get someone independently to see whether or not we had been irresponsible. And it's really great to see the conclusion of the judge, who said, no, the authors and the publishers went through everything they possibly could. We are now in a dilemma here that really we have got a potential of a trial being unpicked. And I would do, you know, I'm not the sort of guy who would want to be, in the one hand, investigating and putting people before the court for punishment and judgment by a jury, and in the same breath be someone who's written an account of that who then undermines that trial. That'd be ridiculous. So for the sake of a matter of 8 weeks to take it off the shelf, whilst unfortunate and regrettable, that, I think, is a responsible thing to have done.
So the book, as I understand it, the intelligence services and the Crown Prosecution Service and the Cabinet Office had all looked at it, but the Met hadn't. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the people who were employing me was the Metropolitan Police Authority, which, you know, read the Met. And also the other authorities you've described were included in it. The reason why I didn't go back to the Met at the time is that the responsibility I had was to the police authority. And all the things that were being talked about in the book were either being led by the Crown Prosecution Service or by the security agencies. And that was the reason.
The Terrorist Hunters claims to be the ultimate inside story of Britain's fight against terrorists, written by Andy Heyman. How goes that fight, in your opinion?
Well, I think we've got a lot to be proud of. And, of course, I say that in a background of terrible tragedy where on the 7th of July, attack was successful and 52 people lost their lives. Wasn't on the intelligence radar. And 2 weeks later, further attempts. But beyond that, what I think we've got to celebrate here is that the 21/7 bombers are now behind bars. A year later, when the authorities, police and colleagues were trying to investigate what happened on 7th of July, and of course then the tragic shooting of Jean-Charles, an innocent man, we had then another major plot, which was the plot to bring down up to something like half a dozen seven transatlantic aircraft flying from the United Kingdom to the United States. And that was successfully stopped, and in part the prosecutions have been successful. And there are lots of other plots that have also been thwarted that don't necessarily reach the public's eye and their profile. They go unspoken about and undiscussed, and I've revealed some of those in the book in a responsible way. And lastly, of course, we had the investigation of the assassination of Litvinenko, which still remains on the books, albeit the Director of Public Prosecutions feels that the evidence has reached the threshold, and if the person we suspect of committing that crime is on these shores, he will be prosecuted.
That's Andrei Logovoi.
Yeah. So when you take a step back from that, yes, it's absolutely dreadful that we've had the loss of life through the attack on the 7th of July. But post that, I think the track record is something to be proud of. And touch wood, that will continue to be the case.
Just on the 7/7 bombers, you said not on the radar. Sadiq Khan had cropped up in surveillance, hadn't he?
Yes, he had. And that's a very good point to raise there. Before I answer that directly, just talk about investigations of serious crime in a general sense. As we sit here now, there will be operations in being right across the country looking at anything from organised crime, we're doing low-level, say, burglary, right away up to armed robberies or drug running. And you'll have a number of people who we call the targets, they're the main perpetrators, and that's where the operation will be focused on. And it's quite likely that while you're on that operation, your surveillance operation, they will associate with different people that you've not seen before and you don't know who they are. And you have to make a judgment that, do we carry on looking at the ones we've set out to analyse, or do we look at these other ones? They'll stay on the radar and we'll do some background work on them, but at some time a judgment needs to be made. If you're not careful, you're a bit like the under-10s on a Sunday morning football team where you're all running off in different directions wherever the ball goes. Actually, you've got to be organised. Going back to where we had with Khan, yes, he was an associate of a known target on another operation, and he did come onto the surveillance plot 2 years or so before the 7/7 bombings. Yes, he did remain a person of interest, but at that time a judgment was made that he didn't come into the main frame of the investigation. It's unlikely that, given what we knew about him at that time, that we would have continued to look at him anyway. Now, that's not being dismissive of the fact that people will think, well, surely if he's now come to police notice and we kept an eye on him, we would have stopped it. Well, you could say that, actually, about over 1,000 people. As the Director General of MI5 has gone on the record to say that any one time there's about 2,000 people of interest, and of that is a hardcore that get quite close surveillance. So, in conclusion, Simon, this is a difficult call. I'm happy from all the things I've read and I know that as much could have been done, and I don't think we could have stopped Khan doing what he did.
On the Jean-Charles de Menezes story, we were talking about this with Sir Ian Blair last week. He came in and talked about his account and his book. At what stage did you realise that the man who'd been shot was not a terrorist or a threat in any way?
Right, the debate here is, what do you work off? You've got to work off reliable information that you know is fact. And there'll be lots of speculation before you get to that point, but you have to actually work off fact. So factually, when did I know the identity of that person? It wasn't until the following morning, and the Metropolitan Police formally didn't know to the early hours of the morning, so some 12 hours after of the incident. Up until that point, we didn't know whether this person was a further terrorist. We certainly knew from 21/7 that we had more devices than we did have suspects, so you could speculate it was someone else. We didn't know that this person may have been an associate. What we did suspect at that time, wrongly as we now know after the event, is that that person did emerge from an address that we were suspected of being a safe house, as it were, or a cell for terrorists. So until we know factually when that was the case, I think it'd be wrong to have speculated or added to that speculation. Where I think, you know, greatest sympathy, apart from the loss of their son, which goes out to the family, is that it must be very difficult to either dismiss or accept a theory. So why it's not being dismissed, and then by not saying anything, implication it's been accepted, your son is being looked at and by the wider public as potentially a terrorist. And that's, apart from their loss of their son, is where I completely understand that they had a grievance and means to complain. But I do think it was the right thing to do until we knew for sure who that person was. We couldn't have got into speculation.
When did you have your first doubts then about whether you'd got the right man?
Well, I think that the incident happened in the morning, and as the day went on, it was certainly a late afternoon, early evening. And I mentioned this and described this in the book as to post certain press conferences and press briefings. We were becoming uneasy in that things that could identify this individual were not linking into either known names of the terrorists that we were seeking to actually get the public to help us catch, because we put the images out, or anyone else come to that. And so then it goes without saying, it's just human nature. You'd be saying, well, we've got to find out who this individual is and get to the bottom of it. But we'd start to come uneasy. But then that's sort of parried in another breath by the fact that we do know from other investigations that these perpetrators, these terrorists, they take on a number of identities, false identities. They have numerous passports, numerous phone SIM cards, terrible number of identities on the computers and emails. And they speak in riddles. So again, you know, it's probably the suspicious mind of the investigator who's looking to prove or disprove things in a rational, balanced way, which will always be looking to, until they get to that point, have an open mind. But if, in point that we're asking your question, when did I, so I can only speak for myself, start to feel uneasy, it was towards the evening of that day.
And looking back on it, do you think that, in retrospect, we started off our conversation by people being wise in hindsight, but yeah, looking back on it, do you think that you should have gone straight away to Ian Blair and said, I'm not sure we've got the right guy, or waited until it was all absolutely clear?
Yeah, I mean, the impression that's been given in different commentaries that, you know, everyone was sitting on their hands and not speaking to everyone. That's not the case. There were lots of meetings going on. But I would imagine that I can recall those conversations, that anyone being a fly on the wall would have seen that maybe we're being overly cautious. we were being overly cautious not to say anything public, to either mislead people in a different way. You know, the accusation levelled at myself was that I misled the public because we didn't put the record straight as to the identity of the person. Well, if I didn't know who that was and I'd gone public with a different message, I could have had the same accusation levied at me. I'm cool about that. You know, I'm not in any way harbouring any sort of problem over that. I just think it's a very difficult call. And what I've tried to do in the book is, in a sort of reasonably open, transparent way, as best I can, is set that out.
We had Ian Blair on the programme last week. As I mentioned, you were colleagues, you were friends, but you don't speak anymore. Is that right?
No, we've something he's shared publicly. That's not from me. And I think those kind of relationships should remain very private.
Well, shall I play you? Let me just play a little clip of the interview. This is a little part of what Sir Ian Blair said on the programme last week, talking about this incident and your friendship. Sure. And Annie Heyman still not returning your calls? Because you were mates, weren't you?
Yeah, we were, which is a great sadness to me.
Why would he not want to talk to you?
Well, I'm afraid that's something perhaps you can ask him.
Well, I will do.
Okay. I'm not going to put motives into somebody else's mouth.
Okay. As I say, he's on the programme next week. What would be, from your point of view, because these are important issues and they're public issues, what would be the point you'd like him to tackle? And I'll put it to him, and then maybe he will.
I don't think I'm going to help you with that, Simon, because he will have given his own account. I've given mine. I don't think I would want to say that Andy has to answer it in any particular way, because one of the difficulties for me, and I make it very clear in the book, is that Andy did the job I asked him to do. I actually brought him in to sort out one of the most difficult problems that the Met had had for a number of years, which was the culture, what was called specialist operations, which was very elitist, very separate from the Met. And under Andy's watch, at my direction, he brought in a whole series of reforms that were bitterly resented by some of the people who worked them in.
I mean, that's just part of the answer
that
he gave. But he certainly seemed to regret the fact that you hadn't spoken.
You could draw that conclusion. And as I say, there's lots of reasons why people don't continue having conversations, not least of which, you know, I've left the force as he has. And I think that those reasons should always remain private. I don't seek to make that public. I don't seek to in any way undermine Ian or accuse Ian of anything, because I don't think that's right at all. I wasn't the person who described the fact we hadn't returned calls. That's something I think is very private.
Do you think that the public, again, this is a point that we were discussing last week, would look at the fallout from this story, the Menezes story, with the tragedy of the man shooting first, but then look at the different accounts? Ian Blair's got his account, Brian Paddock's got his account, you've got your account. It's a bit poor, isn't it?
People would probably come to that conclusion, but you know what? I think you started off this sort of part of the conversation as to the difference of opinion between Ian and myself. Actually, there's not that much difference. The only difference would be the time at which Ian learnt of the true identity and the true account of what happened. And that was shared with him, the first opportunity, by colleagues at a meeting. Now, I think if we'd try to, in any way, brief Ian before that, when it was so cloudy, there's so much uncertainty, you know, people could have gone off at all kinds of tangents. And I think, you know, we were trying to support him rather than undermine him. Now, how that gets played out afterwards, you know, it's all very difficult. I can understand that.
And one thing you make very clear in your book, and that is that you think that there should be, and one day there will be, a public inquiry into the events of what led up to and the events of the 7th of July.
Yeah, I've thought long and hard about this, Simon. I could be accused of being a bit of a chameleon here, because I have changed my view. I held the view when Charles Clarke came in and said he wanted something much shorter and briefer than the public inquiry. I supported that because we were under siege, really. We had so much operationally on. But now, having spoken more to the victims, and I make comparisons between train crashes or where one person might have lost their life, or, you know, a loss of life in police custody, they attract public inquiries. And yet here, the first time that we've ever had suicide attackers on the streets of London, where 52 people lost their life, and the public who are involved in that or on the fringes of that, either bereaved or victims or witnesses themselves, do not feel as if they've had their concerns resolved, and they're desperate for a line to be drawn underneath it. why don't we do it while it's remaining fairly fresh in people's minds? Because the worst thing we'd want is something like the Bloody Sunday inquiry, which was years afterwards when people, their memories become much faded, and I think it doesn't really serve the right purposes. So that's my motivation for saying that, nothing more than that.
Do you think it will take maybe a general election, maybe a different generation of politicians, maybe a different part? I don't know. What would it take, do you think, to actually get to that point where all the stars are in alignment and that public inquiry does happen?
Not in any way making a political comment here, but I think, you know, an administration that has now their colours through one particular mast, i.e. not having a public inquiry, to be seen to coming into a general election to change their mind could be seen to be indecisive and a U-turn. It might be easier for a fresh set of eyes, a new administration, whether it's the same colour or a different colour politically, to look at things afresh, and maybe that's the opportunity.
Andy Heyman is with us. The Terrorist Hunters is his book. And Sarah in York asking you to define a terrorist.
Oh, dear, that's a...
Well, it's straightforward, but
exam
actually...
question, actually. Yes. Yeah, it's very, that's a very, very straightforward question, but... how do you go about answering it? I think it comes, my understanding, it comes from someone who brings terror. And nothing worse could be than some of the attacks that we've seen, the methodology that's used across the world. I mean, if you look at the sort of Mumbai, where there's a sort of siege into a hotel where people have infiltrated, terrorists have infiltrated the hotel as workers and as guests beforehand. The Sri Lankan cricket team, an ambush. Our terrible attacks ourselves, 9/11, going back to the Irish terrorism days, all those incidents are of extreme violence that bring about a loss of life and damage, and they bring in terror. The threat of that brings terror into people's lives. So therefore, if you are the promulgator of that, you're a terrorist.
We've been talking about the events of 2005 and around that. Has the terror threat receded, do you think, since then?
No, I mean, obviously, for the reasons that obviously everyone, I'm not in touch with the intelligence picture having retired. But I think I would imagine, having spoken to colleagues in general terms, is that they're as busy as they ever have been when I was in the post. The thing that people would look to give them some kind of indication, a bit like a weather vane, is the degree of the terror threat. And recently, the terror threat was reduced. That would be wrong for people to draw comfort from that. It was only 2 weeks before 7/7 where the terror threat was reduced. The reduction or increase of that terror threat is only linked to the intelligence that you know about. So you're only as good as the things you know, not the things you don't know. So at the moment, what they're saying, the authorities, when they reduce that terror threat, is on the information intelligence that we're aware of, is there such an imminence of a threat? It's still dangerous out there and still should be worried, but it's not as grave as when we were seeing it, say, 6 months earlier. But we should never, ever lower our guard, Simon, no way.
But knowing what you know, do you behave any differently as you go about your life as an ordinary citizen to the way everyone else would behave?
Do you know what I'm now realising? 2 years out of the service, I'm not critical of the public anymore, who I used to get frustrated about because their memories are so short. It's one thing to say that when you're seeing it and living it every day, as I was, but it's another when you then get on with your life and you're determined not to let other people ruin it. I remember going on the tube in July of 2005, both after the attacks and after the attempts 2 weeks later, and the atmosphere and the behaviour of travellers was something I've never experienced before. People were moving out of carriages when they thought they were uneasy about individuals. They weren't even travelling, and life was so much different to what we're used to. It was also quite noticeable that very short time after that, life returned back to normal, because memories are very short when it comes to this. If it's not there in front of you all the time, events take over. And I used to be critical. Now I understand it. This year, my life has been dominated by the news of financial markets or by G20 or wherever else it might come onto the radar, your news radar. How much have I been thinking about terrorism? Well, I do a little bit more than most people because of my background. But my memory's fading like everyone else does.
I just wonder whether that police instinct, which you had over many decades, whether it's still there. You know, if you're in a crowded area, if you're at a sports game or if you're in a shopping centre, whether you're looking round far more than someone else would be.
Yeah, I mean, I could probably be accused of being quite a bore, actually, because I will make judgments about certain places to go into. If I go into a pub, and there's an uneasy atmosphere in there, then I won't go in there. And how many times people will look at that themselves, I don't know. And I do look at people's behaviour quite a lot. I mean, only the other day I was out with a colleague and literally travelling from one location to the other, and I noticed a drug deal go down on the street, which he didn't. He wasn't a former cop, he's a journalist. So that is a good example, probably, where a lot of things pass people by. But if you've built up in a profession, which I have since I left school, you're never going to lose that instinct.
You've already touched on the Andre Lugovoy question, who is the suspect for the murder of Alexander Litvinenko, which it reads as an astonishing sequence in the book, really. People will remember the story, of course. But did you ever come to any conclusions yourself as to, we think it was Lugovoy, and it was a particularly hideous way for Alexander Litvinenko, remember, as a British citizen, to die. Why was he killed with radioactive poisoning? What was wrong with, you know, arsenic, or what was wrong? Did they want that death to be as public and as drawn out as possible?
Goodness knows. It could have been a lot quicker and a lot easier and a lot safer, not only for the perpetrator, the murderer, but also those around that person. What was interesting when I wrote that particular chapter, and I hope people who get to read it enjoy it the way we've read it, the way we've written it, is that the significance of that case is that we had a talking murder victim. How many times do you have a talking murder victim? Never. You might have a dying declaration, but we were with this individual for up to 2 weeks. It wasn't until towards the end that we realised that he wasn't naturally ill. He'd actually been poisoned and he relived it. I think the other thing about it was that, and who knows who was really behind it, but it was, as I put in the book, it was only a year or so previous to that that I had the privilege to be invited by the then Prime Minister and the Director General of MI5 to meet Putin, where security matters were discussed. And the atmosphere there was very congenial and very cooperative, and one left that meeting feeling that things were very constructive. Whatever your theory you want to hang your hat on, a year later, we've got this dreadful assassination, and that's what it was, where not only was the person poisoned, but the hotel room he stayed in, the public areas he visited, the aircraft he travelled in. There was one point when the Home Secretary, Dr. John Reid, was chairing the emergency meeting of ministers known as COBRA, and we didn't really know whether those who had been in close contact with the victim, i.e. the nursing staff or the police officers, were themselves at risk of radioactive poisoning or maybe cancer threats and risks down the line. It was absolutely appalling. And I remember going to some senior colleague in the intelligence agencies who I went there cock-a-hoop one day and said, it's come back from the Director of Public Prosecutions, we're there, we've reached the threshold, and all we've now got to do is dupe Lugovoy back into this country. And I was that young, fresh-faced sort of cop, very enthusiastic about the success that we'd achieved all together, only to be looked over the glasses by a very wise owl saying, Andy, I absolutely admire your enthusiasm. Let's just see if that day ever comes.
You mentioned COBRA. Remind us what it stands for.
Yeah, actually, it sounds very attractive and
sounds very spooks-like.
It does, yes, but it's pretty boring, actually. It just refers to Cabinet Office Briefing Room. That's it.
Yes, and you're very well. You're pretty critical of the whole setup. Consistently through your book, you say it's a stage for those just looking to impress, that information got shared with the public that we didn't think should have been. And you mention all kinds of incidents that back that up.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, my starting point is that no one that goes to COBRA, be it a civil servant, be it a police officer, and a spook or a minister, goes there anything to do other than to do their hardest and do the best job they possibly can to protect the public and investigate whatever it might be. But I think, having said that, all those different players have all got different aims in life and purposes. Ministers have got their political outlook and they've got to make very important decisions. And cops, operationally, working with the spooks to try and get the best information to the ministers to make that decision, and civil servants to advise them. You put everyone in the same room in the wake of a crisis or to avert a crisis. I don't care who you are, you roll your sleeves up and you play Miss Marple. and suddenly your area of expertise or specialism starts to get blurred. And so what I was witnessing was not anyone being mischievous or difficult. I just saw people overstepping what their boundary of operation was. And all I've advocated is, look, this can be easily solved. We stumbled into a way of working in the post-crisis that we dealt with in those 3 years, where we had a demarcation between what the political decision needed to be and what the operational advice was to get there. And I don't think those meetings should be together. I think the operational side should meet independently and then come to ministers who then have their own meeting, and they are blessed with the most informed position that they can make a ministerial decision. To get that all mixed up before that, I think, is a recipe for disaster. So although I may have been facetious calling people Miss Marple or Sherlock Holmes, that's how it felt. I guess they probably look at me and think, well, you try to be a minister as well.
Do you watch Spooks, Andy?
Occasionally.
What do you think?
Well, it's a bit like, I used to watch The Bill. quite like The Bill, actually. I think
I've always imagined that The Bill might be slightly closer to what actually happens than The Spooks.
Well, actually, I probably looked at The Bill to learn how to do the job sometimes. But with Spooks, I think it suits the drama of TV, and there must be some resemblance to what actually goes on. But having not been a spook myself, I'm probably not the best person to ask.
Well, you say that.
Yeah.
We've only got your word. just a final point, and it's back on 7th of July. And I mentioned this because we're still getting texts and emails on this subject. Ian, I asked this exactly the same stuff to Ian Blair when he came in. And it seems to be one of those ongoing stories. He had never heard of this. But a number of listeners talking about a supposed terror training exercise at the same tube stations on the same day. On the 7th of July. And as I said, I mentioned this point to Ian Blair. He said it was news to him. No such exercise was being carried out. But it's a persistent story that's around. Is it news to you as well?
Yeah, I mean, I would have liked to have thought in my position that I may well have been aware of that. I've got no idea whatsoever of any operation that was running there, and I would have done. Maybe what was happening is there was a lot of confusion at the time of the attacks. There was a lot of activity probably within minutes of what we thought was a fire actually on the underground rather than an attack. And it could be that people's memories maybe are saying they link that to a exercise rather than actually seeing it was the real event.
Yes, and also some listeners thinking that it might be Peter Allen talking to Peter Power of Visor Consultants on this day, but what he was actually talking about was a mock attack carried out in 2003. Anyway, so there's all a number of stories jumbling up, but it has become what appears to be a myth.
Well, maybe, to dispel it, if there is anyone out there that was doing some kind of exercise, wherever it was from, it doesn't have to be the police or the security, it could have been commerce, business. Come forward and say it.
That's Andy Heyman. His book is The Terrorist Hunters. Thanks for listening. More tomorrow.
On digital and online at bbc.co.uk/5live. This is BBC Radio 5 Live. If you like this podcast, you may also like this one. Mark Kermode's and Simon Mayo's film review.
It is molecular movie making, worth a watch for the spectacular scenery.
Foamy, that means
foamy.
Souffle. It's like that French term, isn't it? A bout de souffle, which literally translated means we're all out of souffle.
Mark Kermode's and Simon Mayo's film review.